Hello, pals o' mine. So I'm at a stoplight, and the driver next to me has Skinner's A Simple Man cranked up. It's great. I'm tempted to look over to see who's driving. As the light turns green, I have to look over. The driver is blatantly staring at me, almost reading my mind. As he's staring, he's nodding to the music and starts singing to it, like communicating with me. Isn't this a kick-ass song? Too bad he was so beat up looking. Did you have a Ouija board when you were a kid? Someone gave it to me as a gift, and I remember sitting in my friend's backyard, and we asked the board what movie stars we each look like. She had auburn hair, so she looked like Sophia Loren. And being a blonde, I looked like Marilyn Monroe. Obviously, someone was manipulating it. Years later, a fellow college student I was dating brought up the subject of the Ouija board for some reason, and I told him I had one, and he decided he was going to show me the correct way to use it. We had to face one another, our knees almost touching, with one half of the board on each of our legs. He told me to ask a question, but not out loud. Well, he was this good-looking guy and was 10 years older, so I mentally asked, "How many women has Richard dated?" I was 19. I don't remember the response, but it definitely slid over to a number. Richard looked a little puzzled. Apparently, he was expecting something to be spelled out. "Did you ask a number question?" I hoped he wouldn't ask what it was. I said, "Yes." He was stunned. It actually worked. He looked at me from that point forward with a different perspective. Over the years, I became more aware of how tuned in I am to the universe, including what we like to call ghosts. It was interesting, though, that when I purchased the recorder that I use for my interviews, that the enclosed pamphlet included verbiage about its use for paranormal investigations. Then I thought about some of the shows I've seen on ghost hunters, and I wondered about the tools they use when trying to capture evidence of the existence of paranormal activity or communicating with ghosts. I spoke with Jennifer Murray of Sacramento Paranormal Investigative Society about the practical aspects of ghost hunting. So what was your personal first experience with the paranormal?
My first experience was actually when I was about 3 years old. I didn't know it at the time, but I was staying at my grandmother's house and I saw my great-grandmother. I woke up and saw a woman sitting in a wheelchair, and she was bluish color. I was terrified because I was three, so I was too scared to call out for my grandmother. My brother, I tried to wake him up. He was there with me in another bed, and he wouldn't wake up. And so I got brave enough to actually go run to my grandmother, and I had the feeling like she was going to grab me if I got somewhere close to her. So I kind of scooted around her as wide as I could, a wide circle, and then I ran to my grandmother and woke her up, and she was like, no. Later on, I come to find out as an adult, probably about 5 years ago, I was talking to my mother about this experience. She told me, well, what did the woman look like? And I explained to her in a wheelchair, and I had this overwhelming feeling that she was going to grab me. Well, her grandma had a stroke, and she lived there in a wheelchair on the premises. My grandmother took care of her, and that was what she would do, was actually grab the kids. Oh. She couldn't speak, but she would grab the kids and, like, squeeze them and hug them and kiss them on them and stuff. And she told me that that's what she used to do, and she said I described her to a T, and it was very, very validating. I mean, I was 3 years old, and I can still remember, that vividly.
You kind of wonder sometimes, are those imaginary friends, or are they actually...
Exactly.
So fast forward to now, Have you had any subsequent experiences, or just kind of a general interest in validating for others as well?
You know, I've actually always been into the paranormal. It scared me so bad that I somehow have blocked out being able to see them anymore. I can't see them, but I can tell you, I can walk into a place. I am sensitive. I can walk into a place and know if there's a couple, how many there are, and usually the sex, age, things like that. Like, I've been touched, I've been, you know, I've heard things, I've had so many different experiences doing this with SPIS since 2008. So the reason I got involved is because I was curious. And then the second reason was because I did want to help people. I wanted to help others, for, you know, if they were having scary experiences. Or the number one question we get all the time is, I just want to know I'm not crazy. And most of the time they aren't. So we are a scientifically based group. So we try, and I try to use my senses, and other people in our group try to use their senses with our scientific.
To complement it?
Yes.
So when you say that you're aware, are you able to see anything, or is it just kind of a knowledge?
It's like
an awareness that there's male or female.
It's like an awareness. It's kind of hard to explain. I don't see them in my mind's eye or anything. Some of my other colleagues can, but I can't see them ever since I was little. I can hear them, I can tell they're there, I can like feel them and things like that, but yeah.
Do people contact you, or do you hear about locations, and or is it both?
It's both. Depending on how busy we are, because it's funny, it comes in ebbs and flows with, you know, people contacting us for help. The summer is generally not as busy, and my theory is that it's because people are out and not at home, and so they're not there to notice things going on.
They're enjoying life.
Exactly. When the weather starts to get crummy and, you know, people are more homebodies, that's when the calls start coming in.
And it gets darker earlier, so.
That too. So between those things, that's my theory anyway. So when we don't have clients contacting us, we do, as a group, find locations that are haunted and go experience those.
So how do you find them? Do you just hear about them and casually, or does one of you pick up?
Actually, I'm a very big nerd.
is this like Nerds Anonymous?
Yes.
Okay.
So I research a lot. There's different niches in the paranormal groups and what people do, and you know, some are more techie, you know, that deal with the technological stuff. There's people that deal with more of the research and history of a place. That's one of my favorite things to do, and I love to travel. So I go ghost hunting. Actually, I just came back from Colorado, and I took my mom, and she went ghost hunting for her first time this last year with me. We went to some historic sites that I...
Like where?
We actually went to the Stanley Hotel, where the Shining was...
The infamous Stanley Hotel.
Yes, yes. And we actually, this year, we actually got stuck in the elevator.
Ew, that's scary generally.
Yeah, it was okay. It wasn't like I tried to debunk it. I tried to ask the front desk if they had, you know, access or whatever. No, they didn't. And you didn't need a key. And it just let us off the floor before the floor I wanted to go to. So it was interesting. I've been there. We went there last two summers.
So what did you pack up?
Last summer we went on their ghost tour that they do. And it's really good, actually. They tell you the history of the place, but then they also tell you the things that are seen and heard and felt. In their music room, a teenage girl died in the 1970s. She froze to death.
Really?
Yes. And she does this trick for the tour guides, not all the time, but she did actually when I was there, where she will slam the door for them. And she did it. At first she didn't, and because I was sitting by the door, and I told her, I said, I'm not afraid, it's okay, you know, because I had that... I always call it my little voice. Like, my little voice was telling me that she didn't want to scare me or something. And so I said out loud, and not even within a minute after I said it, she closed the door.
70s is fairly recent, considering
yes.
Some more historical places.
Yes. There's lots of other ghosts there, too. There's a lot of children ghosts there.
I always find that so sad.
Yeah. Yeah, we do, too. Generally, because we are a scientifically based group, we... depend on the client if they want to have the ghosts move on or whatever. That's their decision. But generally when it comes to ghost children, we try to get them to cross over if we can in any way, shape, or form that we can get them to. But a lot of paranormal investigators will tell you it's kind of hard to get children to cross over.
And why do you think that is?
They're scared. They don't trust. They don't know. They don't, the unknown. So many different reasons. I truly feel that ghosts are pretty much who they were in real life. So if they were jolly, funny kind of guy, then they're going to be that way in death. With children, they haven't formed their minds as much, and the world hasn't expanded so much. They rely on the people that took care of them, you know. Learn not to trust strangers.
What seems like, though, then you would ask for someone that they knew
mm-hmm.
to reach out for them.
We do try that. We've only had a couple cases, thank goodness. I mean, I don't mean to say that, but they're really tough to handle. But we've only had a couple cases of with dealing with ghost children. Yeah, that's what we try and do.
Now, are there cases where you don't want someone to cross over? Is that because they're just kind of hanging out? They're just an extension of the family and there's no reason for it? Or
exactly. Like I said, it's, for me, it is, they're inviting us into their home. Our client is inviting us into their home to, you know, ask for help or to do whatever they want us to do. If they want us to have them leave, we can try, you know, we can't say for a guarantee for sure that they're going to leave, but we can try and help them along with that. But it's my belief, it's not my place to say, you know, I will give my scientific opinion and also my personal, like what our group feels as a group. You know, if this person, you know, I think needs to cross over, then we will tell them that. But I will not overstep the boundaries of the client. And that's kind of where it gets kind of tricky sometimes. It's not usually a problem, but like if you feel like this person is very unhappy and is stuck and doesn't want to be there, and the clients say no, you know, we don't want you to make them leave, then...
Well, my personal opinion is it's not their call.
Mm-hmm.
If a physical person were stuck somewhere, you would help them.
Right, right.
So just because they're deceased doesn't mean that you can't help them.
Right.
You don't necessarily have to tell the client. I understand what your predicament is, but for me, it's pretty clear.
Right.
I don't know. It's narcissistic. It's selfish
mm-hmm.
to keep someone there that's not happy. It's pretty obvious.
Usually, like I said, we usually don't have that problem ever. It's just that is kind of, I think maybe once we've had that issue. And I agree with, I am all about compassion and about helping our fellow human beings, alive or not. Like I said, SPIS, scientifically based group that is coming into your house, helping you as a client, as a person. Yes, I agree with trying to help them move on if we can.
So tell me some of the scenarios that you walk into, maybe that you didn't see coming and your client wasn't aware of even.
Well, it's always such a rush and such a, like, yes, when you get verification, like validation of a case. This one case that we had, we actually, my girlfriend and I, one of my lead investigators, Katie, they were saying that there was something going on in the attic of this place. So we crawled up there and we both got this very strong image of a black man in his late 20s, like in the room with us. I don't scare easy, but I started to feel claustrophobic in the room. So I don't know what happened to him in real life, like how he died or anything like that. But not even a week after we had been there, the client's daughter, little daughter, 6-year-old, said that there's a black man up in the attic. That I was just like, wow, okay, you know what I mean? Like, it's not just me and Katie thinking something's going on. It was just very specific. And when that happens, that is...
So was the call because of noises in the attic? Is that why you were
asked
to come out?
No, actually it wasn't. And so that's why when you asked what happened then that you weren't expecting. That was something that we weren't expecting. We were expecting, they were hearing things in the hallways and they were hearing things in the back rooms. And yes, we did get some of those things. But to, like I said, it's always nice to have validation of. So I don't, something else I do, I don't always tell all of my paranormal investigators that come on an investigation all of the specific details, so that only the client and I know some of them, so that
you don't influence and plant ideas.
Yes. That happens a lot where they have the thing happen and they're like, do they have issues with so-and-so or this going on? And after we're done, I will tell everybody.
So what's the oldest structure that you've been in?
Oh, goodness. Probably Virginia City. We, our group, SPIS, takes a annual trip, weekend trip, just SPIS, and we don't sleep for the entire weekend, but we stay at the Miner's Cabin at Gold Hill Hotel, which is one of the first hotels in, I want to say, Nevada. And we actually have been to the Washoe Club, the Millionaires Club, a couple of times. So that was actually built in the 1800s. That place is very, very active. Yes.
I'm surprised that some places continue to be active considering how many psychics, paranormal investigators go through their doors and assist people who have passed to cross over.
Mm-hmm.
Why are all these high numbers of people still there?
My honest opinion is that I don't think that they cross over. I think that they do. Some people are able to help. I mean, that might be not widely held opinion, but I feel that because there are so many, it's really hard to believe that
you can get them all.
Yeah, I do.
Well, that was quite an active place in its day.
Oh yes, it still is. I mean, they finally opened back up and are doing tours daily, and the ghosts are.
You say open back up, did they do some renovations? Or?
Yes, they did. They had some huge holes in the floors and things like that. They had to, the person that owns it, his name is Scott, he's trying to bring it back to life. He's doing that all through tours. He put new floors in, and they just did a new roof, and they've done some really great work with the place.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so, but I feel like they, you know, maybe they do think that they have gone over, and they're just hiding from them, you know, because they don't want to be bothered and trying to move on or whatever. But I just feel like it's up to the ghost.
Well, we are each unique.
Mm-hmm.
And so each one would have to be assisted with in a unique manner. You can't do a general.
Exactly.
Across the board.
Exactly.
That would take a lot of patience and a lot of time. And speaking of which, in Ghost Hunters, I noticed that how many hours do they spend in these locations?
Oh, they spend, like, usually a couple days.
Really?
Yes. It gets cut so down so much.
I figured it got cut down, but I just thought it was, like, one night.
Oh, wow. Not usually. It's usually a whole weekend, and you just sit there for hours.
I know.
You know, ghost hunting isn't always the funnest thing. Like, those TV shows make it out to be. It's, you sit in the dark for 3 hours and you're talking to yourself, you know.
So, you know. Plus, I wonder, do you have a time limit that you set out?
Usually, if we have activity, we'll go until about 2 or 3. And if we don't have any activity whatsoever, we will stop at probably about 1 a.m. in the morning.
You come back a second time just in case it was an off night?
If the client asks us to. But not usually. So
it has to be obvious and something you're picking up really quickly.
Yes. Yeah. Because we are volunteers, so we do have our own lives. And, you know.
While we're still alive, we would like to spend quality time in there.
Exactly.
So let's talk about your different tools that you use.
Okay. We have an IR camera system, which is an infrared video camera setup. We have one with audio and 3 without. And we set those up in different places to try and catch anything.
Do you have a particular brands or favorites?
You know, we just upgraded our system actually to what's called the Night Owl. And that's actually worked pretty good for us. It's so expensive. Like I said, we're a volunteer group, and the only money that we have come in is through donations, and that doesn't happen very often. So it's...
How would you go about receiving donations or fundraiser or just...
You know what? Actually, we do membership fees. So that covers our website fees and our phone number and any kind of like batteries, things like that. And we try and save up money to buy other kinds of equipment. We have, you know, of course, K2s. We have a new tool that has actually worked pretty interesting. It's called a Periscope, and Paranologies, I think, makes it. And it's run off of static electricity instead of magnetic electricity.
Hmm.
And it lights up like a rainbow. And it's actually pretty, it's been pretty good at picking up things the K2 can't. So I don't know if it's just the ghost's energy fields, or I'm not sure, you know, the makeup of them or whatever is different for them to be able to use it. But we've had actual conversations with ghosts with this item.
Can you give me an example?
A lot of our cases, you know, we're all about confidentiality, so I can't.
Of course.
But I can tell you, at Washoe, we had this conversation with one of the women that used to work there, and she was answering our questions, yes and no. Like, and every time the answer was yes, she would light up the lights. It was very interesting. And then we also got a couple EVPs, running EVPs, while that happened too. And you can hear her saying yes. So that was pretty neat.
Do you ever get together with other investigation groups around the country?
When I travel, I will contact groups sometimes. We also have a sister group here in Sacramento, Full Moon Paranormal. We do events with them. We just actually went a couple weeks ago and investigated the Forest Hill Bridge.
For my listeners, a lot of jumpers.
Yeah, yeah. We went during the day and then stayed into the night. And got some interesting things. Not a lot of residual, but there was also some intelligent.
Could you pick it up at the bridge itself or
yes.
And or at the bottom?
Yeah. We went to the bottom at night. My group was pretty brave because they were like, there's animals. And I said, well, you know, let's do it. I had this feeling that it was at the bottom of the bridge. So we went ourselves and armed with a rock, big rocks, and our equipment. And we think we might have gotten some stuff, but we're not positive. Our K2s and our periscopes did not go off, but we think that we got some audios.
So you haven't listened to it yet?
I didn't have an audio running, so one of my other investigators did.
Well, the reason I asked if you got together with other groups is you could share information, like the tools, and maybe they could share what has worked for them.
Oh, yes. Yes, we do. And the same thing with, like I said, our Full Moon Paranormal investigators, Corrine and Karen, the co-founders, and Jesse, they don't have an IR system. So we'll use that sometimes if they have a case that we go on with them, you know. And if we don't have enough people to cover for this or that, then people will come and from their team to ours or ours to theirs and help. We try to be about para-unity, and we know, you know, some of the Sacramento groups, but people usually tend to be, because of the confidentiality, it usually is kept to themselves as a unit.
So for those who are listening and they think that maybe their home or maybe even their workplace may be haunted, for lack of a better word, what steps would you suggest that they follow?
I suggest that they contact a reputable group, do your research.
But what if there isn't one around? Is there anything they can do themselves?
My first suggestion is to try and keep a journal of activity that they think might be questionable. And then they can try, usually talking to them, honestly, just talking to them and saying, hey, I know you're here, or talk to them. That's usually what they want the most. And that usually alleviates a lot. You know, you can also tell them and, you know, give them rules, or tell them that this is your space and you don't want them in it. And One thing I do really highly suggest is, like you were saying, we were saying earlier about people, individual people being, you know, believing in different things. I think a lot of times evil or bad spirits, quote unquote, get put in a box because they get upset because somebody might have used some kind of religious holy water or, you know, the Lord's Prayer, or that it's not because they're bad. It just means that they might not believe in what you believe in, religion-wise or whatever beliefs. I've run into that a lot. It's usually not, it's somebody from an Asian culture who, you know, is Buddhist or something else, or the Native Americans, they were so prosecuted by the Westerners and things like that. So that is something that I would really be careful of if you're doing something.
Be conscious of that.
Yes, yes.
So they are guests in your home of sorts, so treat them that way.
Yes.
As Jennifer indicated, if a ghost is trying to get your attention, expressing an interest in what it's trying to communicate would be a good start. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to Hagerman Fossil Beds National Monument in Idaho, where you will find the world's richest known deposits of fossil horses, which are said to be a link between prehistoric and modern horses. You can view a skeleton of the famous Hagerman horse at the visitor center. Other fossil remains are here as well, representing an entire paleontological ecosystem with a variety of habitats, such as riparian, wetland, and grassland savanna. Since the Smithsonian Institution directed fossil excavations in the early 1930s, other museums and research institutions have conducted research here as well. One summer, paleontologists discovered an articulated skeleton of a suckerfish. Another interesting facet about the area is the Oregon Trail, which crosses the southern portion of the fossil beds, and trail ruts can be seen from the Oregon Trail Overlook parking lot. One Summer, America 1927 by Bill Bryson. First of all, if you haven't read Bill Bryson's books, you have been deprived. He provides humorous commentary and observations while you learn a thing or two, sometimes at the same time he does, such as his visits to the Appalachian Trail in Australia. He's written a multitude of tomes. I was introduced to Bryson with his book, The Lost Continent, Travels in Small Town America. It was so funny. He decided to follow the routes taken during his childhood on family road trips. And as you know, our memories usually don't always match up with reality. And often those places that you hold dear in your memories have starkly altered over the subsequent years. For example, he wrote about visiting the Smithsonian during one of those childhood road trips when items in the Smithsonian were displayed haphazardly, such as an item of Abraham Lincoln's next to a toy top or something. It was an adventure of discovery, like crawling through an old attic. You never knew what you would find next. Today, it's not as fun because everything has been so thoroughly organized. It's just taken the fun of discovery out of it. But back to his current book, One Summer. It's about all the historical events that occurred during this one summer in 1927 and the fascinating 6 degrees of separation that occur. Here's an example from early in the book. He's writing about what's going on in the country during the period immediately before Charles Lindbergh made his famous flight. A myriad of famous people fill in the backstories. One pilot who's attempting to make flying history is Francesco de Pinedo. He's touring around the United States, which includes Chicago. Who is part of his official reception in Chicago? Al Capone. It was the first time any gangster had been invited into society. Now, we all know how Capone was finally brought down, but do you know who was behind it? Mabel Walker Wilbrandt. Mabel went from a California housewife to attorney. In 1927, she's Assistant Attorney General in the Harding administration, given special responsibility for enforcing prohibition and income tax laws. She was struck by the fact that mobsters never filed income tax returns. When she initially went after a bootlegger in South Carolina, Manly Sullivan, his attorneys argued that claiming a share of the illegal profits, the government would make itself an accessory to the original crime. a breach of its fiduciary responsibilities. A federal appeals court judge, Martin Thomas Manton, was also against it. He said, quote, "It is hard to conceive of Congress ever having had in mind that the government be paid a part of the income, gains, or profits derived from successfully carrying on this crime. It is incredible to believe that it was intended that a bootlegger be dignified as a taxpayer for his illegal profit, so that the government may accept his money for governmental purposes, as it accepts the money of the honest merchant taxpayer." Judge Manton was actually successfully prosecuted later by the IRS for non-payment of taxes after he was found guilty of pocketing $186,000 in bribes. He served 17 months in a federal penitentiary. Meanwhile, bootlegger Sullivan, his case was brought all the way up to the Supreme Court by Mabel. It was scheduled to be decided by the court the day after Capone met Pinedo in Chicago. Meanwhile, in Michigan, a man blew up a school, killing 44, 37 of them children, because a bank was about to foreclose on his farm, an act he blamed on local school taxes. The school was across the fields from a summer cottage where Capone liked to spend his time. That's only a couple pages in this book. All these stories that are intertwined, like I say, 6 degrees of separation. You really should treat yourself to the most interesting book of this country's history, only because it's a slice of time, one season, and how so many events and stories are intertwined and affect the future. I would have done so much better in school if textbooks were like this one. Again, it's One Summer by Bill Bryson. Do something different. Take a photo through your sunglasses.